line for Lickin' On Lending.
Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us.
Welcome to Lickin' On Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news, all related to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Transformational Mortgage Solutions. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now here's your host of Lickin' On Lending, David Lickin.
Let's begin.
Welcome, listeners. This is an important topic that we're all wondering about these days, the direction of interest rates. What can we anticipate this year, next year? Joining me on the podcast today is Les Parker. All of you know him well. Les, would you introduce our esteemed guests today?
Wow, this is wonderful to get to introduce the additional panelists today. And we'll start off with the leader of the band, you might say. Doug Duncan has been the chief economist at MBA. Now he's been a chief economist at Fannie Mae for a number of years now. And he is the leading award-winning economist in our industry. And last year got the top award that any economist can receive in the United States. Doug Duncan is with us. And then we have Matt Graham. You introduce Matt Graham every single week. So we have Matt Graham that is the co-founder of MBS Live and knows everything about MBS pricing and how it impacts day to day. He does absolutely fabulous commentary on the site. I know I read it every day and I read his wrap up and his lead in, and it's concise and it's great. And then Adam Quinones, who's been a friend of mine now for over 10 years, and we've worked on a number of different projects, but Adam Quinones is truly one of the great minds in our industry. And he was a co-founder of MBS Live back 11 or 12 years ago, or whenever it was really getting going, or 15 years ago. And now Thomson Reuters made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And after his legs healed, after he got kneecapped, he was there for about 10 years and did a great job. He went from had a little tiny world that they gave him, and at the end he was the head of mortgage for Thomson Reuters globally. So he's done fabulous stuff. He's basically areas around yield book has been amazing what he does. And then the last point is that with Adam Quinones, he has also looked into a lot of areas on AI, because we've been looking at how do we get a more predictive answer on prepayment speeds. And that's where Adam is just doing some fabulous research in his company, Data Collab.
Let's get started. Les, you produce a wonderful 1 minute soundbite. I think it's appropriate to kick this interview off. Let's go ahead and listen to it and then open the interview. Here it is.
Oh, bully bearish. TM Spotlight Soundbites is brought to you by PowerSeller. Making hedging easy.
Oh, bully bears, how were we supposed to know?
The bully bears had the Fed in its corner, but now Chairman Powell says the higher for longer is predicated on data. Signs of the economy faltering will send bears to the exit and let the bulls school the bears. Will Powell take his last shot at tightening come November 1st? A final tightening suggests recession sooner and longer. Either way, tightening is over.
Give bulls the sign. Hit it maybe one more time.
These views are mine. Prepare for the alarm at tmspotlight.com.
So let's get started with the questions. So here we are on the eve of what many see as a Fed's last realistic chance to increase interest rates before the 2024 presidential election season. What are your thoughts on the outlook for tomorrow, which is where we anticipate something or something not happening? How much will the Fed's action or inaction impact rates in 2024? Doug, love to get started with you on this.
Sure. I don't have the luxury of not being public to publish forecasts every month, so you can actually look and see what my view is. We don't have the Fed making any changes for the rest of this year. If you want to weigh the risks, I cannot hide my true thoughts. It's my responsibility to make a public forecast every month. Our current view on the market with regard to rates is that the Fed is done increasing for the foreseeable future. The next move is likely to be a cut. But to the extent that forecast is wrong, it would lead to another increase as opposed to cut closer in the nearer term. So we don't actually have them cutting until the middle of next year. And what that means is we take the Powell at his word that it's going to be higher for longer, because there are some folks that think they'll cut sooner than that. But there's another way to interpret that too. That is, when they do cut, they will cut more slowly than they have cut in the past. That's another way to interpret that. That's what we've built into the forecast.
Adam, it's your reflection, thoughts on this.
I think Doug's forecast lines up with what the market's telling us. Last week, or October 19th, the Fed Chair Powell, he had a speech at the Economic Club of New York, and there was a noticeable change in his tone. And the easiest way to summarize it is, it's not how high anymore, it's for how much longer are we going to stay this high. That's the first time since the beginning of the summer where he's given us any slack or any hope of a potential, an actual true pause or stopping the hikes. And it certainly paves the path for a cut sometime next summer, which is what the market's predicting right now.
Matt, your thoughts?
Yeah, at the risk of being too cohesive here, Powell took that opportunity to reiterate what a slew of Fed speakers had said over the preceding 2 weeks. And it really seemed as if they had a coordinated effort to come out and reiterate that we have enough restriction in the pipeline. We're hearing from our contacts that there is some early stage signs of economic weakness that isn't yet reflected in the data. Our contacts are telling us that things are starting to get a little bit tougher, so we want to wait and see how it goes. I think Bostic said that he sees his next move as a cut sometime toward the end of 2024. If everything, that's the nature of forecasts, right? You only know what you know today, and you have to make your best guess. If things were to proceed as down the middle as they could, then that seems about right. But I would add just a word of caution to people who love low rates as much as I do, that if there is going to be a big recessionary shift that precipitates rate cutting, it has yet to manifest itself in terms of a root cause. And usually those shifts have root causes that you might not be able to see them coming, but you can speculate about them a little bit better than we can currently speculate about potential causes, if that makes sense.
There is a possibility the Fed tightens tomorrow. The market doesn't expect it, but if it does, then we'll get a recession sooner and for longer. But if they in fact do nothing, which is what we expect, the curve might steepen a little bit more. And then I expect that we'll get a moderation in rates and that rates will actually decline some. And that path will accelerate when data prove it.
You think there'll be a strong market response if they come out and say, we are definitively done raising?
That's right. We're done raising, so the market's going to be interpreting. We have a lot of flash indicators that are giving signs, giving us green shoots that we're headed to recession. And I expect that to accelerate. And when it accelerates, that's when we get a pretty rapid drop in the long end. And the mortgages will be drug along by the Treasury long end. And the short end will lag. And so I do actually think we're going to go back to further inversion. But that will go away fairly quickly when the market says, oh, the Fed is going to be easing, say, Doug's forecast in mid of 2024. And that will cause the short end then to catch up with the long end, and then we get back to equilibrium. I want to ask Matt a question. Matt, you've been on this, we need data, and which is what any good trader does. And you're a market observer and you deal with traders every day. So what's the end game for the mortgage industry to get the Fed to guarantee that it will never sell its MBS portfolio? That's what MBA is pushing for, and we've got the industry pushing for it. So what do you think of that, Matt?
I don't do advocacy or trade groups or politics or anything like that, so it's a little bit of a different world. I understand that MBA and others need to advocate for their home team, and I do that in my own way by giving them objective data and the way I see it. I think that the letter was probably unnecessary given what the Fed has communicated. They've been very clear that they have no intention of selling MBS, and that if they ever did, they would give a lot of advanced notice. There's no reason for them to consider it with spreads as wide as they are. Powell has commented several times that QT on cruise control is actually going just as well as they want it to. And there's, you know, they're happy with how that process is playing out. Could they say something like that? No, I don't think you can ever promise that. You can't say to the market, we promise we'll never sell MBS, because there could be a situation where they want to. If spreads were ever as narrow as they were in 2021, granted, that would probably have to be due to the Fed buying bonds again. But let's say there was some other reason that they were that narrow. It would be a fantastic opportunity to sell MBS, and nobody in the mortgage industry would care, because spreads would be tight and rates would be low and rates would likely be very stable. So then nobody's going to care that they're selling MBS. Right now, it's people are trying to address pain that they're feeling. It's a very painful time in the mortgage industry, and we're grasping for anything that can alleviate that pain without distorting the overall financial market. So trying to get a little bit of extra love for MBS and for spreads is one way to potentially do that. But once that pain goes away, then that stuff won't be necessary anymore.
What do we have to lose if they sell? Seriously.
Yeah.
Mortgages are already at record wides. If they were to sell them, give them to me. I'll make an ETF of discount mortgage-backed securities and let investors play on the idea that these borrowers are eventually going to have to refi just maybe to pay off credit card bills. But the idea of having a mortgage-backed security that's fast below par, meaning that prepays faster when it was bought below par, it means you get your value back that you pay. If you paid 90, you get your principal back at $1. So that's a great trade. At this point, obviously, the Fed can't just flood the market, but we have nothing really to lose. And I didn't understand why that letter needed to come out. When were we ever talking about the Fed selling their mortgage-backed securities portfolio?
Some people think the Fed is selling. Some high-profile people think the Fed is selling. And they're wrong about that, and it's mind-boggling. So I think there's some misunderstanding as to the differences between QT and actual selling. So yes, the balance sheet is decreasing, but they're not
reinvesting and selling.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. But in this case, it's like we have not a lot to lose. I mean, if the Fed were to flood the entire market, then yeah, that would be bad, but it would certainly steepen up the curve for us and help banks out a bit, but maybe not so much on their balance sheet valuations. But I'd like to own some of those discount mortgage-backed securities and get paid back at par. That'd be nice.
Part of that conversation would go into how fast are they going to sell, with what regularity, that kind of thing. So there would be some discussion of the calibration of that process. They do have a formal statement that they eventually want to have no mortgage-backed securities. That's part of their formal public policy. They have just said that they've not considered selling out of the market.
What is the likeliness of that happening, Doug? Them not owning any, given the last housing crisis, how so many people got burned in that. Is that a fantasy? Is that realistic?
Our internal view is that they would maintain a small portfolio so the mechanics of it are still in place in the event that in some emergency they wanted to activate that. Mind you, Powell, if you go back to the minutes of the meetings prior to, and I guess now you can get the transcripts, of the meetings when he was first a governor, but not the chairman, he was actually skeptical of buying mortgage-backed securities and moving them away from their traditional path of treasuries. I will say he has demonstrated a pretty serious resolve about some things people didn't think he would have that much resolve about. And when you raised the question about whether or not the Fed would consider raising rates during an election year, I actually think he would put the 2% target above the politics of that. At the outset of the pandemic, you can argue that the Fed was monetizing some of that issuance of debt that was behind the stimulus package. But I do think he's pretty resolved. And were he to see a reemergence of inflation of any meaningful size, he would act against that.
Selling the portfolio could help with that. Selling the portfolio could certainly help steepen the curve up and ding inflation a little bit. Just let rates run. I hear the policy, but the odds are very low of them selling it. Maybe letting it run off is another thing. But
I think that's the more realistic view, I suspect, is the odds of that happening are very low.
Part of the issue is that the Fed is not an economic buyer. They're a policy buyer. So they went into the market to remove volatility and to provide some benefits to consumers. And so part of the issue that the market is facing is who replaces the Fed and at what yields and how they behave over the next cycle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when you're starting to consider lobbying in U.S. political process, how do national elections influence Fed policy, Doug? And will it be difficult for the Fed to increase rates in 2024, given that it's election year?
The idea that the Fed is not a political institution is a myth.
It's a myth, yeah.
Alan Greenspan used to make out a list of politicians that he wanted to join him on the roof of the Federal Reserve Building in Washington to watch the 4th of July fireworks. So this is an institution that attempts to be astute about its political environment to protect whatever element of independence that they feel they have. So to the extent there's not a driving need for them to make a move during an election year, they would prefer, I think, to abstain.
Matt, thoughts?
I'm not quite as resolved on that as Doug. I tend to push back on the politicization of the Fed. Did I say that right? Anyway, you knew what I meant. But to his point earlier, they'll do what they need to do. I do think Powell would place monetary policy over any political considerations. And also, I would say that from a political standpoint, what they have said in the past, and I could see this being the way that politics comes into play, is they don't want to be perceived as having any undue influence for either party. I don't think that Powell's a Republican, and a lot of people that say that he's going to try to do something to help Biden. So I don't really get that. Never really understood that. I do think they're about as independent as they can be, considering that they're the government's bank.
Yeah, the idea that the Fed isn't political holds as much water as us saying that Fannie and Freddie's guarantee isn't explicit. I think Janet Yellen has done a pretty good job of being the Fed's political mouthpiece the last few months. And she's been quite vocal on saying that higher for longer isn't necessarily that long, and trying to say that it's essentially not going to hurt the U.S.'s ability to service its debt, i.e. the Fed is saying what it has to say because it's the Fed, but Janet Yellen, being an ex-Fed president, is saying exactly what Jerome Powell really wants to say. Jerome Powell has to keep the market on a tight leash for obvious reasons. Over the last year, we had, what, four false starts on the short end of the curve where the twos rallied and they ultimately bounced back higher, and that caused a lot of chaos for traders, for investors, for mortgage rates. I think it's interesting to watch how the Treasury Secretary overlays what the Fed is doing, especially given that our Treasury Secretary is an ex-Fed president.
Interesting.
Yeah, if you show me non-farm payrolls under 100,000 3 months in a row, and then CPI, month-over-month core CPI at 0.1 or less for 3 months in a row, the Fed might cut in spring of 2024. And I think they all know that. And I don't think that they can put that on the dots, because that's not the reality today. But it's absolutely a possibility.
Matt, I remember you saying once that the Fed views housing as part of the problem. I was wondering what your thought is on that. And maybe you could share with
a problem that it's creating.
Your yearning for Bernanke days.
Those were blessings and curses.
Matt, can I just tear the Band-Aid off on that?
Yeah.
After COVID, the Fed did something very different with their bond buying programs. They told the market that they were going to buy the lowest coupon possible. In previous open market operations, the Fed just said, you produce it, we'll buy it. But not after COVID. They said, go produce 1.5s. So for the entirety of spring and summer, we had originators trying to write 2% and 1.5% MBS coupons. And the Fed was buying up more than we could produce. Ultimately, what happened was you had collateral going into TBA trades, which TBAs you would consider worst case delivery. And what that means is you put your fastest expected prepay speed loans in a pool and deliver that into TBA. But what was happening is the Fed was buying so much that originators were having to put specified pool inventory into TBA trades. So TBAs were trading even higher than what the Fed expected. And when you couple that with the fact that we had this gigantic spike in appraisal waivers, home prices went up big time. Coupled the extra drop in mortgage rates with appraisal waivers building on top of one another, we had a pretty large increase in home prices, which generally we've come down a little bit, but that spike in home prices really hasn't corrected. And Doug, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but like it hasn't corrected. And that has been a significant source of inflation, which is still why our CPI numbers remain high.
Not to mention those 2.5% mortgage rates freeing up hundreds of dollars a month in cash flow that's driving inflation outside the housing market. Also housing related inflation, in my opinion, because it was driven by savings in housing expenses. And furthermore, while it's not the Fed's doing, being able to get a free endorsement to skip as many mortgage payments as you want under the forbearance programs, that frees up a lot of cash too. That's also housing related. But my biggest gripe with the Fed, and I think their biggest gripe with themselves, I really think that they've apologized for this, admitted it, seen the error in their ways, hindsight 2020. But in 2021, or let's say hindsight 2021, because that was the year where they just kept their foot on the accelerator of QE and relentlessly continued to buy MBS, even though spreads were at all-time tights, even though there were some early signs that inflation might be picking up. But they were determined to make sure, and this was their justification, you can decide for yourself, honest or realistic you think this is, they were determined to make sure the economy had its best chance to recover from lockdowns and the post-COVID volatility. And they thought that by continuing to ease aggressively, it would give the economy its best shot. They were also, unfortunately, just hard on the heels of their inflation framework revision, where they had concluded that, oh, hey, QE doesn't really stoke that much inflation. Look at the past 10 years. We did a ton of QE, didn't have much inflation. So we can have this symmetric inflation target. We can keep it above 2% for a little bit to balance out the time it was below 2%. And yeah, let's just ease. We're just going to give the economy its best chance. And that really set, it pulled forward so much volume in the mortgage business from the future to the present. And now we're having to pay that back. And it's very unpleasant. A lot of people didn't see it coming in exactly the way that it came. But that those low rates, all that excess cash flow, and the certainty that rates were going to be lower, go lower, really drove prices higher and inflation higher, and thus the Fed and the housing market, part of the inflation problem.
Doug, well, could you comment on that housing? Could you comment on this housing supply and all of those imbalances that were brought about by these external forces? What are your thoughts on that?
I want to add to what Matt said by saying that at the same time as that was going on in fiscal policy, we're making massive transfers to households, which they divided into two parts. One is to reduce debt, so credit card balances fell dramatically. The other one was to increase savings. Both of those, combined with the savings they're getting from the reduction in mortgage payments, all was powder that they could deploy in consumption, which they did, and fed into the inflation metrics. On the housing side, part of the reason house prices went up, if you tracked, which we did, the transfers to, say, a family of three that were qualified for all the income transfers, and if they saved that, there was around $11,500, which if you looked at a 3% down mortgage, you could get about a $380,000 house. So at that time, if you divided in any market, the prices in that market of housing by upper third, middle third, and bottom third, they were increasing fastest in reverse order. In other words, the lowest third was increasing much faster than the middle and the higher. And so you could see the acceleration in housing, all of which ran against the boomers who continue to do what they've always promised to do, which is age in place. And now you've got the Gen Xers who never get any airtime, but we've been giving them some airtime. They're the ones that locked in the 3% to 4% mortgages, and they're going nowhere. So now you have essentially two-thirds of the demographic, or more than that, of the demographic that have locked in ownership in a property. They have no intention of changing anytime soon, which puts the balance of the pressure on the builders. And you can see this in a couple of metrics. The share of total home sales that are new home sales is the highest it's been for a very long time. And the share of new home sales, which are first-time buyers, is the highest share that you've seen for a very long time, which simply points out the problem is that existing homeowners like their homes and they're not giving them up.
Yeah, and if they do, they'll probably rent them.
Yeah, that's exactly. You're creating a future bunch of investors in those Gen Xers who are going to keep that house because the mortgage payment's below what the rents are in that market. Yeah. And you did see a really, I'm telling crowds, you saw the market work very quickly on a combined set of events. When mortgage rates passed 7, you guys can explain better than me, the sort of a seizure, wasn't really a seize up, but a slowing of the MBS market because investors did not believe that MBS backed by 7% mortgages was going to be there as soon as the Fed eased. And so what you saw was the builders came in the market with 2% buy downs because they had margin to give. And they knew that their marginal buyer was a first time buyer whose problem is not granite countertops and finished basements. It's financing. And they could get them into what they'd ultimately have to refinance to in a couple of years anyway and keep their business flowing. It happened within a 2-week time period. It was really magical to watch that. Occur.
Les, any thoughts you want to add to that before we move on?
No, I'm just shaking my head. Not negatively, but positively on all.
Nodding is the word.
Yes. Nodding.
Yeah. I'm nodding off. No,
not nodding, nodding off. No, nodding you got a couple off. More years yet.
That's my territory.
I guess what I could comment on is that on this equilibrium aspect, true that we don't live in equilibrium. However, we go through equilibrium, right? Just like the guillotine. At the lowest point, if you think of that as the equilibrium, where all the weight is and everything. So what I'm concerned with is that we had massive disruption in reasonable movements in markets. And the first massive disruption was the financial crisis in 2007-08. And then we had many things, many MINI items that crept in until we had COVID. And because during that 10-year period, more or less, 12-year period, the Federal Reserve was aggressively managing the markets. And a couple times they decide, we don't really want to be in this game. And then the market said, we want you in the game. So they had to stay in it. And then COVID had a huge change in how governments intervened. And so with massive intervention by the Fed and massive intervention now by fiscal policy, how long, Doug, does it take to get those extremes, you might say, those interventions into a more normal, meaning that the government, the Fed is not aggressively influencing markets and that the markets handle most of the activity. How long does it take for us to get there?
I would measure it in years, 3 to 5, yes, maybe. So I've been going around for the last year and a half asking mortgage lenders, do you think mortgage lending is still secured lending? The reason I asked that question is, with the great financial crisis and the pandemic, we saw massive intervention to reset the terms of contracts. And it's not clear to me that the market has appropriately priced that change in distance from the collateral. Because in the past, there was the security that you could seize the collateral for non-payment. We've changed that dynamic. So there are a couple of questions. One is, do spreads reflect that? Is it true? We actually have research projects underway with some academics on this. The second one is the prevention of foreclosure in some sense puts a floor under the housing cycle. And does that floor artificially retain house prices at a higher level than they would be if you went through the full cycle, including foreclosures? I think those are interesting questions from a policy perspective. And I would suggest that things may not, what we think of as normal refers back to a cycle where economic forces worked across the cycle without policy intervention. That hasn't happened the last couple of times. So question what normal looks like. That's why I'm saying maybe 3 to 5 years. Plus you got all that.
So you're researching now what you're asking researchers to tell us, can you please define a capricious government and what the bound and how they bound themselves? That is, what are their extremes? Is that
What I told the academic, I said, look, Doug Duncan is not asking for a headline that says, Doug thinks it's a good thing if we have a lot of foreclosures. That's not what I'm after. What I'm after is to understand the implications of policy. There's always a first round impact, but rarely do policymakers consider second round impacts. And we're trying to investigate the second round impact.
Interesting.
I want to jump in with something there. It might be too far off the beaten path, so you tell me, Dave, but just thinking about that sentiment and about what Les was saying after the great financial crisis, and he didn't use these words, but we got addicted to easy monetary policy as a vehicle to reduce volatility. And I remember writing a post at one point that said the Fed is trying to engineer a softer landing. This was like 2013, 2014 timeframe, where we looked at the last several instances of Fed easing and how that played out in terms of rates and GDP. And I wonder what the smart guys on this call think about the Fed and even the government going too far to reduce pain and volatility. Is there a too much? I think there is. And do you agree? Can you overdo it in trying to keep things so even keeled that you're removing some of the natural volatility in financial markets that is actually healthy long term? And how do we advocate for that? How do we advocate for spending less money, doing less QE, letting the economy experience a little bit more pain, if you agree that's a good thing? Yeah. Hopefully you can intuit the rest of my question, because I feel like I could ramble on about it without really asking it the way I want.
One of the biggest impacts that I saw working on trading floors for 10 years was the slow and steady exodus of top tier talent, because there was no opportunity to make money. The repressed volatility environments made primary dealers essentially become order takers, where there was very little margin in the screen. They would buy for one price and the Fed would buy for almost the exact same price. So what we witnessed is generational talent that came up and learned from the best minds to ever work in the bond market exit the sell side and go to the buy side. And since the Fed has truly exited, we have experienced the ramifications of that. We have a lot of primary dealer trading desks now that are not populated by 30, 40 year veterans who are mentoring the next generation. We have guys that came up during the Fed's QE era that never have really experienced a market without a buyer of last resort. So what we've witnessed is wide bid-ask spreads in production coupons, a total lack of liquidity, and difficulty making rate sheets. And this is primarily a function because of that talent exodus. And I don't know how long that takes to get fixed, because most of the guys that left the sell side, the top tier talent, to go to the buy side, or they either that or they retired, they're not coming back. So the market's learning on the job right now, and that's going to take a little bit of time.
What's the impact of that? Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I completely agree with that. Volatility is one of the factors that leads willing buyers and sellers to make decisions on risk and prices the placement of assets, where we believe in a market-based economy, that it's that the private sector operating independently allocates resources, and misallocated resources get lost. They get devalued, and that's the pain that Matt's talking about. And I believe, take that to Powell, what Powell's trying to accomplish, two things. One is to get rid of the double dip recession possibility that occurred in the Volcker administration. And the other one is to get rid of the Greenspan put, which says benefits will be privatized and costs will be socialized. I believe he wants to get rid of that cost being socialized and let markets clear by giving clear signals of including in volatility. So I think we've gone way too far. I think Powell actually recognizes that and would like to move the markets back to more appropriate market-based pricing.
So that would lead to this question, I think. Is the mortgage industry, Doug and Adam, I like your thoughts on this, is the mortgage industry still cyclical? And if volumes increase, will mortgage companies reemerge and mortgage loan officers reappear at the comparable rates that they were prior to the current uptick of rates? Or will scale arrive in mortgage banking? Are we still cyclical? And so therefore the expansion, the new mortgage companies coming back and MLOs coming back, it all goes right back to how it was before. Or are we truly entering a new world with scale, fewer players, and fewer loan officers?
I don't believe it'll be back to normal until the Fed's portfolio is small enough that market participants think that it's unimportant to current pricing. And then until you work through the lock-in effect from the people that have got 3% mortgages, and they also become only marginal to the functioning of the supply and demand factors in the economy. So I think that's why I'm saying 3 to 5 years from now, because I think it will take that long to marginalize those things. The Fed's portfolio might go faster than that. I don't know. But that's what I think.
So during this process, I remember it was a little over a year ago when I first heard you say it. And so I'll say that you had said that over the next 5 years or so, you anticipate mortgage rates being between 5 and 7. And that I remember my response to you when I heard it privately was, I think if you add 1% on both sides, I'd be in agreement with you. So between 8 and 4 instead of 7, 5 and 7. Are you still thinking that we're in that type of a range? Maybe you want to, I don't know if I've read
it. You're saying 5 to 7 range?
Wanting to narrow him down to specifically, but do you still think that it's a somewhat, there's a definable range over the next, say, 4 more years in as we go to this normalization?
I do want to, I'll comment, and then I want to hear Adam's comment to your previous question, because I'm interested in that. The way I think about it is mortgage rates from World War II out to 2000, roughly, were about 6% nominal 30-year fixed rate mortgage rate. And that was over an economy that grew in real terms on average 3% annually, including recessions. Today, the CBO estimates potential GDP at 1.75%. Maybe it's a little bit faster. I'm not sure. Depends on where policy is. But if you make some adjustment, and then I factor in the fact that we're issuing public debt at risk, historic paces. So maybe rates don't come all the way down to where you might if you equilibrated that World War II to 2000 level. Over the cycle of housing, when it's restored, I would see rates running somewhere between 4.5% and 6% with a middle range of 5.25%. But there's a bunch of assumptions in there. One is that the Fed has got inflation back to their 2% level sustainably. And there is some sort of fiscal discipline that is restored to mean real growth can be around that 2% number on a sustainable basis. So that's what I'm telling people at mortgage lenders. If I was planning, I would think about a cycle like that. But then it gets back to that research piece we're doing on, are we going to allow foreclosures? If we don't allow foreclosures, that's going to alter things as well.
So the reason I wanted to add 1% to your 5 to 7 was that on the long end in the bond, we look at implied volatility. It has been running hot for a while now. We are the lowest I think we've been in the last 3 or 4 years since COVID. So since 2019 has been 12, and we were up over 20. Just as a relative scale, so that's high. Historically, we were between 8 and 12. So just give you longer term type ranges. So I feel like the long end is saying it's a volatile market for a lot of different reasons. And that's why I do think we could see mortgage rates at this 8 or a little higher. But I do think we can see mortgage rates back down into the 5s, even into the 4s. So I see a wider range for it. That's the only difference that I'm seeing. Adam, I had posed a question about basically, is the mortgage industry cyclical, or will it introduce scale and actually see fewer loan officers and fewer companies for basically forever now?
Potentially. It's always funny talking to mortgage bankers on the topic of automation and artificial intelligence. Doug's office actually just put out pretty fantastic survey results that I was eager to read through. In 2018, I believe, the number of people in the industry or respondents that were familiar with AI and machine learning was 63%. In 2023, the number is 65 now. Makes you question that initial 63, doesn't it?
It does.
The adoption rate has gone up considerably. So in 2018, 42% of respondents expected to adopt AI, and now 73% expect to adopt it. When it comes to cyclicality in this industry, you have to look at the owners and what their objectives are and how they behave in the downside of the cycles, the bearish side of it. Are they just taking their money and running and closing up shop, or are they sticking around and investing in cleansing data, normalizing processes, ensuring that their P&Ls are correcting defects and errors on the fly? The amount of information that is required to be cleansed prior to having proper adoption of artificial intelligence is generally underappreciated by the industry. And unless you've QA'd petabytes of data and normalized the data and flattened it out and looked at it from every loan represents a row, so you've got over 100 million rows with 3,000 columns, and you have cleansed that data to the point where you're comfortable in building on it, it's hard to build AI that you can actually trust. And then on top of that, the integration complexity into existing systems, there's a lot of barriers. And I do believe that there are several lenders right now that have prioritized that work in this part of the cycle, and they will absolutely scale and outperform smaller shops. Now, will the smaller shops just start selling best efforts again, or mandatory one-offs to those aggregators? Maybe. Will they need loan officers? You're never going to get rid of a loan officer. Maybe we need fewer loan officers. Maybe we need fewer loan officer assistants. Maybe we need fewer processors. But no loan is the same. Even the most vanilla loans require attention to detail. The borrower needs an explanation. So we'll never get rid of loan officers. But the cyclicality on the revenue side, of course, that's going to be here forever. Whether or not the expense side is flattened out and reliant on just purely compute cost of the data cluster, I think that it's going to take the rise of a very smart mortgage brain in this industry who understands data quality and can communicate the importance to originators and servicers and actually demonstrate the value of it before it's actually adopted. Because right now, the last couple of years, I think a lot of people have been burned by the prospect of AI and have spent a bunch of money and seen no results.
That's a great point. Doug, when we're talking about data integrity and you look at generative AI and how it's coming in, what's Fannie Mae's view on this? And you have a unique position having been at the MBA with Ms. Moe and all of the data standards. You have a unique perspective on the crappy quality of the data that's generally there in our industry.
Yeah, I was there for the formation of MISMO, and the whole point of that was data quality and to improve the manufacturing. And when the first couple of modules were put together and a couple of people experimented with it, and they were like, gosh, the data suck. And we're like, yeah, it always has. You just didn't really realize it until it was revealed. That's still ongoing. And I agree with Adam, it will be a continual hurdle for the business to make improvements in that area. As I was thinking about this question, to some degree, the industry could use somebody like Southwest Airlines to be a pattern. So the beauty of Southwest was they said, look, we can make our operation efficient by using only one airplane, and that every airport, the staff is absolutely trained exactly the same. All the parts are the same. That we can standardize this thing and make it extremely efficient. I keep watching for mortgage bankers who would look at things on the back side of the company to convert fixed cost to variable cost so that when volumes are cyclically high or cyclically low, they can adjust their cost structure very quickly because the costs become our variable costs. But they've invested much more on, to Adam's point, in supporting the loan officers who are always going to be there, their interface with consumers.
Very interesting.
I don't have an optimistic view of the future of loan officers. I think loan officers are going to become more and more customer service representatives. I expect them to just mainly be counselors. I think the sales aspect of mortgage bank of loan officers is going to dissipate rapidly. And so in the cycle that we're talking about, if quote unquote normalization arrives in 4 years or so, that normalization will be a new normal. The new normal will be fewer players, and that there will be more technology-driven answers, and that the loan officer's role will be supporting the customer and answering questions and guiding them through the process. Not, it won't be sales. I think referrals are going to also dramatically change on how it gets into the system. Now, how it all looks, I don't have an answer, but I'm not very optimistic about the mortgage loan officers are off 50% from their peaks, maybe more. And I think the odds of those numbers, even if we went back to a $4 trillion industry, I think is zero that we get back to the same levels of loan officers.
Especially with automation.
Don't mind being controversial. I'm not a public company having to make statements only that goes through vendors. Like
Adam, do you have a position on this or any thoughts on this? You articulated that you're probably more, there's greater probability of less than more of a resurgence coming back. Did I hear you correctly?
If we're going to be thinking about it from the perspective of generative AI, it would require an incredibly impressive knowledge base, content set of problem-solving scenarios where you had loan officers that had been chatting and talking to each other and solving problems for 15, 20 years. And there was an expertise and an ability to identify the actual solution. That would train AI to be able to have a borrower come in and say, this is my scenario. How do I need to have my files set up? Without that, you need loan officers to set up files. It is incredibly, like I said, same.
Yeah, and I think, but is it more also explaining the transaction? Because it's one of the most complicated transactions. Well, it's simple for us. We work in this world. But for the average consumer that's coming in, they need it explained. They need it broken down. And there's a certain level of just emotional reassurance that they're getting the right deal for them. And I think that's why the loan officer, I think, will always be around. Now, will we be able to scale them because of artificial intelligence coming in and playing a greater role? I think that's distinctly possible, and I have solid evidence of that happening, which I'll talk to you guys about after turn off the recorder here in a minute. But we're actually seeing that beginning to happen, and they've been doing it for the last 15, 20 years of working on the data sets. So we're actually seeing this, and it's very encouraging as we look at some of these trends. I wanted to get the perspective about the National Association of Realtors lawsuit. Does that going to have any impact on the housing market? Is it an event that's going to impact the NAR? Or any thoughts on that, Doug?
I have not spent a lot of time thinking about it. I guess the question is, someone's going to get paid. Does that pay become part of the mortgage, or is it cash that has to be paid outside the system so that it creates another hurdle for...
Right.
Or a different hurdle for the borrower.
Yeah, we just released a podcast. James Duiggins, CEO of Next Home, really has some really good perspective on that. We just released that yesterday or the day before. It's a podcast on that. So I just want to get your thoughts on that. It's really good to hear. As far as MSR values, we've touched on that again. Adam, you have studied this extensively. For the average mortgage banker that's holding MSRs, even if that MSR coupon value is below 5. Is this something you should be holding on? I'm thinking of Basel III and the impacts. While it doesn't impact IMBs directly, it's going to impact who they're leveraging through the banks. Let me get your thoughts. A lot of questions coming to us right now. Should we hold them or fold them?
I'll let Doug and Les comment on the Basel side, but we have seen over the last year and a half or so significant amount of volatility in MSR valuations. I've also seen large non-banks be willing to put larger multiples on their portfolio. And a lot of people question those valuations. And I look at them and I say, no, actually, you know, they have no intention of selling that portfolio. They're going to recapture it. And they're putting logical assumptions on top of that valuation. So do they really need to run their prepay speeds at what the Monte Carlo model spits out? And this is important because when the yield curve is inverted, when the forward curve is inverted to spot curve, when implied volatility is high, what happens is the MSR models will spit out a drastic decline in value anytime rates rally. So think last July, think November, think February. This is something that is a very hard problem to solve for MSR valuation shops. And then what happens when rates bounce back higher? You don't get it all back. So something that we've advised and we've been trying to help with is getting a second opinion, a cash flow based opinion that is bifurcates your portfolio into, is it in the money or is it out of the money? And in the money can mean you can really draw your line. You can draw it at 4.5%, 4%, and you're still 90 some percent of the portfolio is still out of the money. And you can run that the portfolio at a 9-10 discount rate and whatever the dealer expectation is for CPR, which is going to be 6 or 7, and you're going to get a better valuation than what many Monte Carlo models will spit out. I think that this problem is largely a function of lenders and servicers just not having to be forced to interrogate their valuation because of the lack of volatility for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. But if you're asking me, do I hold or do I sell? I've been telling people to hold their, okay, so maybe not new production Ginnies. So new production Ginnies would be the odd man out here. But everything else, I'm telling people, don't sell unless you have to. And yes, there are a lot of shops that are selling just to raise cash. But in this environment, I'm okay to hold my portfolio as long as I can hold it, economically speaking, from a cash perspective, because I want to recapture it. Take every opportunity you can to recapture it. Have full control over your portfolio. And absolutely question your MSR valuation provider. And what I mean by that is just get a second opinion. Have it be a cash flow based opinion. Don't go off something that's going to be heavily influenced by what the MSR buyers are out there trying to, you know, tell you, which is they're not going to run a CPR below 7, and most of their discount rates are going to be above 9.5. Not the best situation. So you're essentially hedging valuation, not the money in the mailbox. The money in the mailbox looks great.
And money in the mailbox, but you hit on a really good point, the ability to recapture. If you have a lousy track record of recapturing the value that of what you're holding, that might also have an influence on that decision. Doug, love to get your thoughts on this question.
Yeah, I can't add to Adam's description. I thought that he was right on point.
All right, Les, we'll let you wrap it up with that. Your thoughts on MSR.
MSRs are trapped by the same game that houses are trapped in. If you have very low rates, there is some movement on the value that Adam was talking about. But if you really look at just the cash flows, they're not going anywhere. So you're at the top of the, we call it in the MSR space, we call it an S curve. So think of an S having a bottom to it and that's flat, and the almost a Z you'd see, but and then the top has a flat area. It's bound.
Sideways.
Yeah. And so it's bound. I was going to say, just in a kind of ending on a very theoretical note, and it's way beyond this conversation, but the future with AI in the area of analytics is going to be significant and it's material. Right now, for the most part, our world, the mortgage banking world, is still a two-dimensional world. It's everyone looks things linearly. They only look at something up or something down. And in a lot of different spaces, the biotech space and certainly rocket scientist space, we're really moving towards what I think will be is a landscape, a landscaping approach, not two-dimensional, but multidimensional, where you really see what's underneath the mountains and you see the mountains. So you see peaks and valleys and you see it over different types of horizons. And how do you manage your risk with that type of view? That's where it's almost, I don't even remember the name of these different movies, but you would see scientific movies where I guess it would be like Star Wars, where they're going all the way through mountains and valleys and all types of things, moving around at very super speeds, because the AI or the intelligence guiding it is not the pilot, but is in fact is able to read the landscape. I think that's where analytics, it is in certain spaces, and it's going to be moving in the mortgage banking space. And that ultimately will cause prices to be more efficient. And when we get more efficient pricing, where it's going to be better for the borrowers. Right now, we are in a very controlled space with government being heavily, it's a significant part, as Doug is in many of his lectures. He's talked about housing is controlled by government in various forms all around the world, some 100% and others have certain amounts of freedom. The U.S. right now has certainly moved into a lot of control with the ownership of the GSEs. But if we can loosen that up some and move into better analytics, and then we have the investors in mortgages having better ways to look at it, I think we'll get more efficient pricing. And as we move into more efficient pricing, it will be the beneficiaries will be the borrowers.
Yep.
I'm going to ask Doug one question.
Yes, please.
Matt and I regularly see on the MBS Live dashboard questions about economists' predictions and forecasts. And Matt and I are pretty consistent with our response. The economy and the way that it operates is changing structurally. People have two jobs. The way that they respond to surveys isn't consistent. And for an economist or any forecaster to build, to update their forecast, it takes time and it takes a measurable time series. I would love for Doug to comment just how difficult that is in terms of a significant shift in their forecast and what it takes, because I don't think the modern armchair economist really truly gets the process that goes into place here. And I think it's a chance for Doug to just explain, hey guys, things are changing and we need information.
Yeah, I actually read a book by a physics professor who has done a bunch of modeling in the climate space. Her book is Escape from Model Land. I'd recommend it. It doesn't have any equations in it, but it explains all the considerations that you have about what's the purpose of a model, how do you judge the results of the model, how do you keep from getting captured by the elegance of the model that you put in place if things are moving in the environment around it. We actually brought her to the company, and that conversation is still reverberating through the company based on the really significant truths that she put in there. She's a better speaker even than the book. The book was very good. We had a conversation about equilibrium. It's the basic flaw in all macro models is they make an assumption, and they need to make some sort of simplification assumption to be able to draw some conclusions about the real world. But it is, in fact, to Les's earlier point, there really isn't an actual equilibrium, because as soon as one trade is made in the next movement, in the next moment, things have changed. So as an example of what you're asking, Adam, I'm suggesting that in the housing market, we will not, I've tried to coin a clever phrase. I call it the geospatial redistribution of real estate values, which falls right off the tongue, right? what it's trying to capture is the fact that the pandemic set in motion a bunch of changes in household behaviors and business behaviors and the economic relationships between those households and those businesses that's going to affect the value of multifamily properties, the value of commercial office space, the value of housing in different geographic locations, based on the decisions that are made between the household and the business about whether compensation is appropriate for measured against productivity. And that's going to take some time to work through. So we're doing what we did at the beginning of the pandemic. We're calling people and we're saying, what are you doing about this? How are you thinking about this? and trying to think about what we were talking about earlier about the quality of data and what kind of data does it take to actually construct a reasonable model that gives you a useful view of the real world. And that's why I'm saying 3 to 5 years from my perspective until we actually know the results of that. And of course, policy will change in the meantime. So you have to factor that in as well.
Great question.
Imagine being in the Federal Reserve shoes in this situation when the economy is changing. It's very difficult. And I understand the frustration with revisions to data, with surprises to data. And the market certainly trades off of it and it monetizes the disconnect. But we're in an environment where everyone's changing their behaviors. And for an economist, economists need time series to model that behavior properly. And we just don't have it yet. And that's a challenge. And it's going
to
cause
they need that behavior to level off and be predictable seasonally and with respect to various inputs. One last question to tag on to that. It's going to sound like a leading question and it's going to sound like a hostile question at first, Doug, but it's not. And this is to address all of the cries from the lay people who aren't economists that are like, oh, how could they be so wrong, those forecasters? And so I just want to ask you, do you put out forecasts because you're a narcissist and want to be right and flex your muscles in a public space and try to shoot the moon, as it were? Or do you put out forecasts because you have a responsibility to your company and because you're trying to provide guidance and clarity to the best of your ability?
I spent some time in the Navy and I would keep the ship's log while watching the captain drive the aircraft carrier that I was on. And just because there was a fog bank that you were going into, you didn't stop the ship. You had to continue to drive. You had radar, you had other people you could talk to. So you gathered whatever information that you could to best navigate through that fog. That's really what it's like running a business, and forecasting has those same issues. You need to have a view of the world because you have to make decisions. It's going to be wrong, but you want to recognize why it was wrong. Was it for the right, were you thinking in the right path? You just got the calibration wrong. It's like being a detective, and I actually read detective novels a little bit to think about how they write, about what clues are. It's a little bit of that.
Good answer.
Great answer. Yeah. Good. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. This has just been one of those really enlightening conversations. This will be one I want to go back and listen to. Got to get that book. What's the name of the book again, Doug, that you just read and you had the speaker come in?
Escape from Model Land.
Escape from Model Land. We got to put a link in that in our show notes. That's going to be my next read. Interesting. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Les, thanks for inspiring this. It was really good. And thank you for pulling this together. I appreciate it. Gentlemen, have a great rest of your day. And it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. Hey, listeners, this hot topic would not be possible without our sponsors. I want to say a special thank you again to Byte Software, Finastra, Total Expert, iEmergent, the Mortgage Bankers Association of America, Lenders One, the Mortgage Collaborative, Knowledge Coop, Mobility MMI, and Modix. Be sure to check out each of those sponsors and their sponsor on our website, Lincoln on Lending, at the sponsorship page. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lincoln on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lincoln of Transformational Mortgage Solutions. Join us next week, and thanks for listening.